recordings are ready, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Carol. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the IRTPD working group call on the 9th of December 2013. On the call today, we have Volker Greiman, Mikey O'Connor, Bob Mountain, Avi Doyer, Holly Raich, Graham Bunton, Caitlin Chubigan, James Waddell, and Barbara Knight. We have apologies from Paul Diaz and Angie Graves. And from staff, we have Lars Hoffman and myself, Natalie Peregrine. I'd like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you, Mikey.
Thanks, Natalie, and thanks, Carol, for the recording help. Welcome all. James has to jump off the call a little early today, so since I'm doing the mind mapping thing anyway, I'll drive today, and so we'll take a look at the standard agenda. And I think today we're just going to work on creating scenarios. We'll see how this goes. If it goes great, we can pat ourselves on the back, and if it doesn't go so great, you can blame Mikey. But I think that's the agenda. So take a look at that, and then let us know if there are any changes to your statement of interest. We'll take a little pause. Look for hands on that. Okay. Well, so on the screen, that all-familiar mind map thing, is it big enough for people? It looks like it's just barely readable. If people find it hard to read, just let me know in the chat, and I'll bump it up a notch. But we had a really productive sort of drafting subgroup call on Thursday, and I summarized the result to the list that basically said, you know, look, let's take another run at this in a slightly different direction. I thought the conversation on the list was terrific. I learned a lot, and it gave me a couple of new things to think about. And where we came out on the Thursday call was that by breaking this into scenarios, we may make our work easier for ourselves. Let me just bump the scale. Thanks, Avery. That's probably going to work better. And so I took what we came up with on Thursday, and then I added just a little bit to it. And then James added one this morning that I think is really good. That says, look, these scenarios have a number of dimensions to them. One is the policy dimension. And so we have some choices there that are just a starter kit. If people can think of more choices for any of these, that's fine. But the thought is that what we would do is we would come up with scenarios and say, this scenario is clearly in scope for IRTPD or IRTP and the TDRP, or it's not. Maybe it's clearly within scope for the new registrant transfer thing that's sort of lingering from IRTPC, or maybe we don't know. And then the next dimension that we thought of was this scenario is a dispute that's entirely between registrants, or it's entirely between registrars, or maybe it's between registrants, but registrars might be a party, or the opposite, or it's a puzzler. Again, always the choice for something we don't really know. And then, again, the same sort of thing with compliance. They either clearly have a role, or they could have a role, or they clearly don't have a role. And then the one that James added this morning, which is some sort of volume dimension that says that this scenario happens all the time, and this scenario is some sort of an edge case. It's very low volume. And I think James raised a really good point, which is that, you know, if we have to choose between something, it would be nice to favor the high volume ones and maybe leave the edge cases to be solved other ways. So I thought that was a good good addition to this. So I thought that what would be neat is if people came up with these scenarios on the list, but I got an echoing silence on that. So I thought instead what I would do is see if we can come up with these on the call. And my hope is that you will all leap forward with scenarios, and I will become the scribe and write them down, and we'll sort of see where we get. So does anybody want to break the ice and go first? Don't all beat the doors down, talk at once or anything. Hey, way to go, Bladel. Go ahead, James.
Sorry, I'm going to get my mute off very quickly. So I think that the two scenarios, and I'm trying to see, am I discouraged from duplicating things that we may have already covered up above there?
Oh, you are discouraged from that because I have control. Hold on.
Okay.
So we came up with some. Where were they? Hang on a minute, folks. Oh, there they are. Examples. Let me grab those. Put them down below.
Okay.
It's like an easy thing to do. I can manage it. Okay. Here we go. There you go. There's the starter kit. I should have put those in the email. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. That makes I think that helps give something to push off on there. So I think that we want to, very early in the process, we want to try to detect and make a distinction between situations where the process was or the scenario was accounted for by the IRTP or the TDRP, but the process failed. For example, the admin contact authorized a transfer, but the registrant is challenging that. And I think that, you know, in those cases, the policy is very clear that the registrant would you know, be able to override that authorization. So we would say that the policy, you know, covered that scenario. And similarly, any case where someone says, this registrar is claiming that they had my authorization to do this transfer, but in fact they did not, so challenging the veracity or authenticity of an authorization. I think where things get sticky is when we have two separate parties claiming with competing claims over the control of the domain name, and by control, I think here, meaning the ability to disposition and transfer it. I think that's where this gets very, very sticky, where it's party A and party B are both claiming that they have exclusive rights to transfer the domain name, and only they can authorize it, and that the authorization from either party is harming them. And I think that was one of the things we touched on. This is a little bit of a non sequitur, but one of the things we touched on in our discussion was, right now, when there's a transfer and then someone disputes the transfer, the status quo is to leave the transfer in place while that dispute is worked out, either between the registrars or TDRP or whatever. But one simple thing we may be able to do is that if any transfer is disputed, we would immediately reverse it and then lock it in that pre-transfer state until that dispute is worked out. And I think the thinking here is that the bulk of the harm comes from allowing the transfer to stand more often than not, than from preventing the transfer from going forward. And I'm sure that there are folks who implement UDRPs that may see that, you know, the other way. But I'm looking at it from the perspective of someone who's had a name hijacked. So I don't know if that's helpful, Mikey, or if that takes us down a rabbit hole, but that's my my thoughts on the scenarios.
I think that's great. You know, it gets us going really nicely. I think I'm going to take that one out. It goofs up my little outline. So what we came up with last on the Thursday call is this starter kit list. And then James added this one at the top. So we have an admin contact authorizing a transfer, but the registrant is challenging it. And that one's covered. We had another one where we had a registrar who is simply not participating. So maybe a losing registrar is not answering queries from people. And I think that one's covered by the by existing policy. That's why we put in the emergency action contact kind of thing. We have a pure registrant-to-registrant dispute. I have acquired a domain, and now the person from whom I got it, my son, let's say, is saying, no, you coerced me into giving it to you because you're bigger than me and I want it back. That's clearly between the two registrants. The registrars did everything right. And I think that one of the things that causes a fair amount of confusion is that right now it's not really clear whether the IRTP pertains to that. Oh, James, you've got your hand up. Sorry.
Yeah, I just wanted to jump in on that last bit. I think there are two different flavors, or let's say at least two different flavors of the registrant-to-registrant dispute. I think one is where both parties were acknowledged at some point as being registrants, maybe not simultaneously or maybe at separate registrars. So one registrar has registrant X and one registrar has registrant Y. I think the other one, the other scenario is where one party is completely unknown and has always been unknown to a registrar. So, for example, we occasionally get calls like this, which is, I want to transfer my domain name because I hired this guy to create a website for my business, and now, he kicked my dog or something terrible and unforgivable, and I don't want to do business with him anymore. So I'd like to transfer my domain name, and when we look it up, we're like, the person who designed your website for you put all of that in his own name. And then this person will, of course, bring out, contracts and bills of sale and all this other stuff, but really, we're not in a position as registrars to say that that person has a legitimate claim over that domain name. So I think there's two scenarios. One is where there are two competing records for registrar, and one is where there's only one, but there's this sort of invisible, undocumented third party claiming control. And I think it's that last scenario where really TDRP, registries, registrars, ICANN really kind of have to throw up their hands and say, really shouldn't be wading into these waters, in my opinion.
Now, let me do my version of that one and see if it fits in the same jar or if it's a new scenario. Because I had a good friend, and then Holly, I'll get to you, but I'm on a roll here, so hang on a minute. I had a good friend who had this is the guy that writes the Imponderables books, things like Why Do Penguins Have Knees, other books that answer questions like that. And his name is Dave Feldman. He's a friend of mine from long, long, long ago. And he had his website built by a website designer that went out of business. And so his name expired. The website designer was gone. So the expiration notices went nowhere. And the first time my pal found out about it was when the name imponderables.com showed up at auction. Is that a different one, James, or is that a subset of the one that you're describing?
It could be a subset of the latter one, or really of either scenario, depending upon whether your friend was ever listed in any of the contact records, contact objects of the Whois record. One of the things that maybe could come out of this group would be best practices that, you know, something that said, look, you know, make sure that if you're hiring someone, and, you know, to do a website, that your name appears as a registrant, even if they are the administrative or technical contact or something. And I know that's pushing water uphill, but it feels like there's a lack of awareness, you know, and just and it leaves registrants vulnerable to the situation you described.
Okay. Type a minute, and then Holly, you're next. Okay, take it away, Holly.
Yeah, it's just, I don't know if these situations are different, but could you distinguish between, say, a person who is down as a contact, possibly wrongly, in the same organization, and somebody in the organization, a different person, thinks they are the registrant and they have the ability to transfer or not? That's one scenario versus registrant, where they're different organizations. So one is a kind of a, for some reason, a mix-up within an organization, and another is a dispute between organizations or individuals. Does that make a difference?
Yes, and I think the I don't know if this is, I was going to put this in as a subset of that one. I think maybe I'll leave it where it was. I like lots of scenarios, because then we get more granular conversation. So I'll leave it for now, and we can sort it out later. It's easier to make things clumpier than it is to invent stuff. Barbara.
Hi, this is Barbara for the transcript.
Oh, Barbara, get a little closer to the microphone. It's really hard to hear you.
Is this better?
It's a little better. Now it's silent. You yelled at the microphone so loud that it broke, and we can't hear
Sorry,
you.
Sorry, can you?
Oh, there we go. That's much better.
Is it too loud?
Yeah, it's good enough.
Okay. So the scenario that I'm thinking of perhaps is with the privacy services. Do we have to address anything with regard to those? Because I think the gaining registrar may very well, if the registrant has not removed the privacy service that approves for the transfer, may not have any visibility into who the registrant is, and how would you go about validating that?
Interesting type ahead problem. Not look at the screen. I'm used to being able to see what I type, and this new version of the software shields it from me. So the losing registrar doesn't remove the privacy service, and the gaining registrar can't validate who they, the registrar, is, right? That's a good one. James, back to you.
Thanks, Mikey. Going back to Holly's scenario, which I think is, and I think you've captured it here, something distinctly different. I think it is. You're making clear that different contacts or different departments within the same organization would have to, but would also be something that maybe this policy is not very effective at sorting out. I think the other situation is when someone, and also very common, almost as common as the web developer scenario, is when someone registers a domain name as part of their work or their job, but puts it in their own personal name or as part of their personal account. And then, for whatever reason, that person and the company are separated, either through, you know, resignation or termination. Who has control of the domain name? And we have had to provide some, build some. I think that's common enough that we've actually built some procedures where someone, where the organization name will trump the registrant name. So if someone says they are with, Acme Incorporated, and the registrant remains Acme Incorporated, but the CEO or the general counsel or somebody from Acme Incorporated produces their business license, their articles of incorporation, and says change this. We have usually devised some mechanisms where they can demonstrate that they are speaking with the authority of Acme Incorporated and remove that other person from the mixed registrant field. So I just wanted to put that one out there as maybe a wrinkle in the scenario that Holly described.
That's a good wrinkle. I'm coping with a computer that just decided to get really hot, probably due to Adobe Connect. Oh, but by bringing up the activity monitor, I scared it into submission. It's much better now. That's weird. I don't get that. But hey, anything that works. Okay, so I'm looking in the chat, and we're getting a pretty good conversation going there. So let me go back. So Rob is, I'm going way back in time. Rob was probably, I don't know which one Rob was agreeing with, but if I captured it right, Rob, that's good. Let's see, right, so then we have a little dialogue about registrant and admin contacts have authority to transfer. And then the ownership argument. I think where we're getting to, okay, and then Rob is answering a question from Kevin, who's saying, really? You can transfer these with privacy on? I guess Rob was asking that question. And then Rob is giving me a thumbs up. So we're okay. Good. I'm liking this. I'm sort of leaning on the registrar's bit, since you are the folks, and also Barbara. Is this the total pile? If we went to your department that deals with goofy disputes, is this list good enough, or have we missed a big one that we need, or even an edge case or two wouldn't be a bad thing? I don't want to beat this to death, but the same time, I think this is a pretty good start for us to start kind of making clumps out of them. And so if we're sort of out of... Volker, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yep, I can hear you now. I couldn't at first.
Okay.
Working.
Just one subset of the privacy services thing, where you say losing registrar does not remove privacy service. This may also be any other entity that's providing the privacy services, for example, a reseller or another business that just uses our registration services. That's much more common because in that case, as a registrar, we don't even know who the registrant is. We only see the privacy service as a registrant.
Now, is there a difference between the privacy and the proxy? Proxy is where the person is actually... I'm treading on thin ice in my knowledge here, so I'm not sure I'm going to get this definition
quite
right.
Well, privacy services and proxy services, there is a differentiation between the two, but not everybody makes that differentiation. Basically, the privacy service just hides the address but leaves the name and provides the owner with a certain degree of privacy, whereas the proxy service actually acts as new registrant and also puts his name in there, besides the address and the email addresses. So privacy services usually, there's always a reference to who owns the domain name, and in the proxy service, there isn't. That's my understanding of the main differentiation.
Yeah, I think that's, and the thing there is that that was sort of my understanding of a proxy service as well, is that this is basically either a law firm or someone else who's acting as the registrant. So that might be a different thing, but we'll capture it for now and catch up to it later. James, go ahead.
Oh, just wanted to echo Volker's statement about the differences between a privacy service and a proxy service, and to point out that there is a PDP on this issue that is underway, and perhaps rather than reaching out and absorbing that edge case, maybe this is one of those scenarios where we direct that other group that is working on these issues to come up with a definition and then adopt some sort of consistent behavior, like what we were discussing in the chat about NACing a transfer request so that until the service is canceled or removed. So just one thought of maybe this is something, like you said, Mikey, we're treading into some dangerous waters here. Maybe we just highlight this issue as work for another team that is focusing on this as its core topic.
Yeah, I think that our situation may be simpler in a way because from my vantage point, a proxy service is essentially the registrant. And, you know, the person that they are at the forefront, doesn't really matter. I mean, so I would think that if a proxy service transferred a domain, that would fall into normal transfer. You know, Joe's pretty good proxy service is transferring from GoDaddy, and that's all, end of story.
If we could say that, I think it's our remit to determine what happens when someone is listed, a person or an entity or a privacy or proxy service is listed as the registrant. It's the work of another group, I think, to determine what registrants should and should not be able to do in that role on behalf of their registrant customers.
Yeah, absolutely right. But I would think that would be the scenario you're describing would fall right into registrant-to-registrant dispute. One being the proxy service, the other being a registrant. You know, off you go to court. Have a great time.
Agree.
And so, unlike the privacy service thing, where unlatching that privacy service might be something that does fall into IRTP so that the gaining registrar can understand who's the losing registrar. Anyway, that's a nice murky pile. We'll put that in the nicely murky. I like at least one or two good murky ones in our search here. Holly, go ahead.
Yeah, just I think it's a slight wrinkle, but remembering the who is final report and the way they defined the proxy service as really an agent. So the lawyer or whoever is an agent of, and they're acting on behalf of. So I think that's a wrinkle of two people within the same organization, in the sense that technically your agent is acting on behalf of you, and then the issue there is, I suppose, the legitimacy of your agency and what was meant when you gave somebody the agent to act or not. I think it's in that category, but it's a little bit difficult because technically it would be probably a lawyer who's the agent, but they're taking instructions from their clients.
Mikey, this is James. Can I jump in on that?
Sure, go ahead.
Holly, that's an excellent point. And I think that it should be covered in the terms of service of the privacy service. Or if it shouldn't, yeah. So I just wanted to throw that out there. Thanks.
Yeah, well, I'm just the only thing I wanted to make sure you really meant proxy and not privacy.
Yeah, I did.
Sorry, either. Proxy, mainly.
Okay, so I'm going to put this one up in the organizational one, at least tentatively. And, you know, as you can see, it's pretty easy to move these back around. Barbara, go ahead.
This is Barbara. So the one that I'm thinking of that was actually brought to my attention by another registry operator is somewhat related to that one that you actually are highlighting just now, which when somebody registers a domain name as part of their job, does it in their personal account, it's somewhat related, but in this particular scenario, somebody who works at the company registers the domain name. It may be in a corporate account, but you know, they have themselves listed as the admin contact or the registrant, and they've left the company, and there's nobody there, you know, who has that email address or access to that email address any longer. I guess kind of related to that, or, you know, that individual may not have passed along the information relative to the, I'll call it corporate account, again, quote.
I think that I'm going to put that in a different category, at least for now, because in this one, there's a dispute, perhaps. I mean, I think the scenario that James was describing when he put this one out there is that the company and the employee disagree about the disposition of the domain, whereas this one is more mechanical in a way and might be treated a little bit differently. And we might even be able to treat it differently in policy, although I'm not sure about that. So anyway, I decided that one warranted its own separate case for now. Christine, you're next.
Hey, thanks everybody. This is Christine from NAF. My apologies for jumping in late, and so maybe you've already discussed this. But I want to just jump back one topic to where we were talking about the privacy and proxy services. And that is that, I mean, I think we can probably spend a fair amount of time delving into who the registrant is for the purposes of registrars. But specifically, since we're talking about dispute resolution, for the purposes of the ICANN dispute resolution policies that are in existence now, like the UDRP and the URS, et cetera, the registrant is the entity listed in the WHOIS record. So, you know, whether or not... I just want to throw that out there for discussion, or not, maybe not for discussion, but just to capture that information, and that is, you know, when you have a discrepancy between who the registrar thinks the registrant is and who the policy thinks the registrant is, there could be an issue there. And maybe it's not related right now, but I just want to throw it out there so we document that in this particular topic.
Sure, that's really where it belongs. Let me just think about that for a minute. Get this down to a place where I can. I'm sorry to mumble. If Cheryl were on the call, she would be saying, "Mikey, you're mumbling again." All right. Okay. I want to put that somewhere else. Chris, go ahead.
Thanks, Mikey. Chris Chaplow. I kept thinking about the case that we've often mentioned before where two business partners split and then they start claiming rights on the domain name. But I think that's probably in the rather nicely phrased registrant says, "I'm the owner, but I'm not in control of the domain name." So I think that probably goes in there, unless anybody's to disagree.
So I'll put it in there for now.
Okay.
I mean, I think that one of the things that we can do with these is give ourselves lots of examples. And by doing that, we may learn something. So I think it's good to have lots of examples.
Okay. Chris, on a follow-up then, what the case above, one registrant is completely unknown to the registrars. Now, is that redundant now? Does that come into the one below, I wonder?
I would say that they are a little bit different. Because I think in that case, you know, our subset cases are the nefarious website designer Chris Chaplow, who either claims the name for themselves or goes away. And now the registrant shows up, like my friend Penguin Dave, and says, "But I've written all these books. I've used this name for a decade and a half. Help me." And I think that's a different case than where there's a dispute. Now, the treatment of that may be the same, but I'm okay leaving those as separate kind of things for now, just to tweak our discussion. I think that, you know, if we go back to sort of why are we doing all this, well, I think the reason we're doing all this is because what I'm imagining is that we'll sort of make a little matrix out of all these dimensions. So we'll have like four columns, and we'll take all these all these cases, and we'll put little tick marks or something in the columns that say, "Well, this is the way they work," and where we have question marks is probably where we're going to have to work harder. And if we find that they're the same when we do that analysis, well, that's fine. We'll just have more examples of that particular situation for the documentation that we undoubtedly will publish as a result of this. So I think it's fine. It's a long-winded answer. Sorry about that. Any others, Chris? You've got lots of experience. Have we missed any of the ones that you've run into over the years?
No, the ones, Chris here again, yeah, the ones that I keep coming against are the website designer case and the business partners, small business partners splitting case.
Yeah, I can imagine. Okay, good. Christine, you're next.
Thanks. Yeah, I just wanted to add to the business dispute one because we see that one kind of a lot. And the other thing to keep in mind is that there may be I know we talked about whether or not the TDRP will apply, and we're going to go through those buckets next. But the thing to also keep in mind is that oftentimes there's contract issues at play there, like there's some sort of agreement, whether it's oral or written, and then there's other issues there as far as when we see that's a variation on a couple of these is where somebody starts a company, is the sole proprietor, maybe domain name is registered to them, they sell off the company or part of it, or maybe they go public, or now there's a board, and the company, the larger company now wants to wrestle control away from this owner who has sort of an interest in the underlying business. So it's similar to the business partners thing and similar to the the person registering on behalf of the company. So there are issues there, I think, that would not be relevant for policies. In fact, these cases that come to UDRP oftentimes because there is some sort of trademark at play, like the large company bought the small company and there is a trademark, and so those do come to UDRP. Those often get kicked out as not being cyber squatting because it's purely a business dispute. But the panel expressly says this needs to go to court. This is more than a documentary hearing. So we have to also, as we're going through this, keep in mind that, you know, we might have buckets, and one of those might be, you know, doesn't apply at all. You know, you must go to court because there's going to be too many legal issues to sort out.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the places we're heading, is a much clearer definition of those cases where we, the policymakers, the registrars, the registrants who we are representing, those of us who are representing registrants, all agree that this one falls outside the policy. I think that will be a great good that we do if we can make that distinction clearer. So, yes, I agree. Kevin, you're next. You're muted.
This is Kevin Woodman. Yeah, I just wanted to add further to Christine's comments that and sort of go back into the history of how the UDRP developed, because before the internet, when there was a trademark infringement, the trademark infringer was within the legal jurisdiction territory of the parties that were having the dispute. So the local dispute resolution, whether it's a court or a tribunal and all that, were all there, and so a conventional legal process would work really well. And I think one of the things that prompted the UDRP is that you could have a trademark infringer that wasn't actually in the jurisdiction where the harm was occurring, and that one of the reliefs that was possible, which was either the suspension or the transfer of the domain, was something that I can't have control over. And I think it's a reasonable policy consideration to not just say whether or not it's suitable for the dispute resolution process, because some disputes may be easier for a tribunal and take actual physical witness testimony and all that than others, but I think it's also important to say, well, gee, if it's a problem, like a lot of these scenarios, the website designer or the business partners, typically they're all in the same jurisdiction, and therefore they can use their legal process to get a resolution, and I don't think that ICANN should step in and say, hey, well, we can provide a different resolution process for that. I think we ought to, as part of our filtering through these scenarios, say, well, gee, we ought to be looking at ICANN for situations where they are a unique jurisdiction, so to speak, that you don't have the remedies available in your local traditional legal jurisdictions. So that's my extra gloss onto Christine's comments. And that's all. Thanks.
Thanks, Kevin. And Christine's giving you a thumbs up on that. And hopefully I captured it right. I think that's it. I think the queue is empty at this point. Let me do a last call on scenarios. This has actually been remarkably productive. And I think what I will do is take an action item out of this to transmogrify this into something that's a little bit easier to read and push it out to the list with the hope that and I think in some cases I'll add a few words because these are pretty terse sometimes. These are more like notes. But maybe what we do is we look to the list in the next day or two for this first try at scenarios. I may even try and clump them a little bit. And let's try to get any that we've missed. So for those of you, especially those of you who deal with these cases all the time or represent organizations that have departments that do that, I will try and make this list suitable for you to take to that department and say, does this cover all the stuff that you see? I'm thinking of James and Volker and Barbara and folks that have a pretty high volume of this kind of stuff going through. And let's try and verify that we've at least covered most of the high spots and then spend next week trying to put these in clumps that we can say, okay, this is clearly in, this is clearly out, et cetera. That seem like a good plan? I'm seeing check marks, and I'm reading the chat. Oh, James is gone. Looks like we have a plan. So I think with that, we'll close a little bit early, and I'll do a little work, hopefully pretty quick, and then we'll see you in a week. Thanks all, and belatedly safe travels to James. And with that,
thanks, Monty.
Thanks.
Catch you later.
I think we can roll up the recording, call it a day. Thanks all.
Thank you.